Joel Friedrich grew up in rural Iowa and attended the University of Iowa and St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he received his BA. After completing a graduate program in teaching certification at the University of New Mexico, he taught high school in Santa Fe for several years and lived a short time in New York City, where he studied book arts. He moved north to study creative writing and poetry at the University of Montana in Missoula, and after receiving his MFA, he and his wife accepted teaching positions at Cho University outside Tokyo, Japan. While living in Japan for 6 years, Joel and Lee, his wife, traveled throughout Asia and the Pacific. Joel Friedrich's poems reflect these travels. His work is a combination of restless wanderlust and a need to articulate a sense of place, as his careful eye records both culture and landscape. His poetry is primarily narrative, but his personal stories of discovery and nature and growing up are often interwoven with myths and folk tales. They are, perhaps, more like surreal fairy tales, which make the familiar seem strange and strange places seem like the stuff of our everyday myths. Just as Joel Friedrich explores the territory where myth and personal history converge, his poetry mines the places where narrative and the lyric overlap. It often flirts with blank verse and leaps with striking metaphor to metaphor through bursts of sound and song, struggling, as he says in one poem, toward what neither you nor I can say. Joel Friedrich is the author of two poetry chapbooks, Without Us, published last August by Finishing Line Press, and The Body We Gather, to be published in December, as the winner of the Kulapai Press's Sense of Place contest. His poems have recently appeared or are forthcoming in Beloit Journal, Natural Bridge, Paris Review, Prairie Schooner, Sou'wester, and River Styx. And that poem won second place in the St. Louis Poetry Center's Stanley Hanks Prize. You didn't know that? You didn't get any money from them? Is there anybody here from the St. Louis Poetry Center? We should talk to them. He has also taught writing and literature at Southern Illinois. Well, congratulations, anyway. He has also taught writing and literature at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, Washington University in St. Louis, Fontbonne University, and University of Maryland University College. He currently is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin, Barron County, and Rice Lake. Please welcome back to St. Louis, Joel Friedrich.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm going to start off with a prose poem from a series I'm working on right now. These are kind of new. This one is in my full-length manuscript, The Valley of the Tongue. I discover the future conditional. Beige smoke clung to village children who'd fled the fires on TV, who always retreated into foliage like dusk's abandoned creatures. Colors were muted, used, as if traveling around the world had exhausted the picture, erased all but the outlines of fear. We turned away from the images into the nation's interior, escaping in my brother's Mustang from a violence we couldn't name. Top down, the first warm day of spring, buds were erupting, pumped full of purple wines. From the dead world, a pale blush rose into our depleted eyes. On the 8-track, Bread or Jethro Tull beat like a heart disassembled in the ruin of March fields. Hills lifted briefly in a far-off haze, dissolved quick as sweetness in our mouths. A year later, my brother would be in the Marines, living with a girl in California, and I'd made up a place for them called the Valley of the Tongue, a name I'd heard in a song, A dead region I revised into a city of sea breezes and palms, where they dwelled in the sweet of star fruit, papaya thick in the air around them, beads of nectar crystallizing in her navel. The sky had begun to flame in his sunglasses. A tachometer was rigged to his pulse, to the flow of breath in his nostrils, and my birth eddied like dust in the burnt lands behind us. He held the wheel with just one finger, as if flying into death would be nothing but a long kiss, as if in the valley of the tongue, our lives would turn liquid as whispered names. The heart would burst its withered husk, and earth's patina of grief burn away until all that's left is a naked, radiant seed, as if in the valley of lips and glottis we'll speak to each need directly. This is this is the poem that was in River Styx a few issues ago, and when Richard talked about the idea of fairy tales, he might have had this poem in mind. It's called Fairy Tale, and it's sort of a montage of disasters. I first started thinking about this poem when we were living in Japan, and the Kobe earthquake had struck, which kind of wiped out that town. And there were images all around us of neighborhoods that had fallen down and people who were buried. And over the years since then, it seemed like I worked on this poem every time something like that happened and I heard about it. There was actually a story about an earthquake in northern India that influenced this poem, in which there was a small child who had been buried for quite a number of days and was found alive, I think, held by her mother. So it's a pretty serious topic. I have to say that in its last rendition, the last rendition of it kind of happened in the week following 9/11, when I was overwhelmed in the woods up in Wisconsin. It's called Fairy Tale. There's a term in here that comes from my time at St. John's, where we study great books from Aristotle. The prima materia is sort of a first matter that Aristotle talked about as all potential formless stuff that can take the imprint of soul. And so I wanted to use that in this. Buildings had fallen. Much of a city was destroyed. Volunteers picked through rubble. Dogs sniffed for survivors. In a northern forest, I was splitting wood, dead oak I'd left whole too long. Everyone I knew was still alive. They wouldn't give estimates. The dead had absorbed the world and become its mass. But they were digging, following a voice down. We could all hear it through devices made for this purpose. It was either the muffled suckling of an infant or the ground struggling to have a voice, calling to us out of its own dense center. The stumps weren't cutting, not splitting easily to fresh grain, while I thought of old myths, transformations, the prima materia of Aristotle and alchemists, a mother substance that holds all the forms love would make out of us. The tale of a Japanese woodcutter who finds an infant living in the center of a hollow tree. But my wood was cross-grained, knotted with lost limbs, lost histories that grew up harder through the middle like iron. After 3 days, they found a newborn sheltered under the arch of her mother's back. Still alive, a form suckled by grief, struggling inside a stiffening shell. When they lifted the mother away, the child must have blinked at the sudden, more distant sky. I'm not saying I can claim the privilege, But when I raised the maul over my head and split apart the goddamn grain, I wanted it to be me cleaving open around her. Japan and sort of different configurations of myths kind of figure a lot in my poems. This poem is from the new book that's coming out in a few weeks. The book's called, or chapbook's called, The Body We Gather. And this one I revised a lot, and it's based on something that happened when we were in Japan the last time a few years ago. And there are street fairs and festivals at shrines and temples. Every month or two, there's something exciting going on in the neighborhood. And you've probably seen the way that the men will carry a portable shrine. They're kind of dressed in white loincloths and going down the road singing and wiggling the shrine above them very heavy. This one has that image in it, and it's actually about one of my sons who was really young at the time getting lost. He actually had a dream about it, I guess, a few weeks ago, called Boy Lost at a Festival. After you'd been returned to me, clutching an old man's sleeves, a man holding goldfish in his hands, after you'd emerged from sinuous enclosing crowds, from stalls selling luck, posters of pop stars' cleavage, steaming cups of shochu that squinched the puffy eyes of drunks, after I could see you again and breathe, I grasped for where you might have been during those minutes your sticky hand had slipped free of mine. Maybe you visited the god sulking in his closet of moths, lifted persimmons from his dry lap, sipped rice wine souring in his cup since the last century. Your fingers might have traced the fine dust of his cheek, the grooves gouged in the block of yew he was hewn from, might have slid around the whorls of his ears, their endless entrances to silence. Maybe you found a hatch at the base of his spine and crawled in. Why not? That imagined world was yours. If you'd called out then, I might have heard your voice lost in the gorges of a god's mind, echoing in my own heart's crumbling altar. Outside, the neighborhood men had begun their chant, koi, koi, koi ya kai, and lifted the whole shrine, you and the local god you'd inhabited, tilting and rocking above the street, koi ya. When they carried you into the Pacific and the sea began to climb around their knees, there was nothing I could have done to reclaim a boy returning to the body that had borne him. But just then, the old man whose name I never learned led you back to me from the crowd. That image of the hatch at the base of the spine, there's actually a giant Buddha in Kamakura, where you can pay about a dime and crawl up into the Buddha and get up in his head and stuff. It's kind of neat. It's funny, on the way over here, we were listening to NPR, and there was a story about a guy who, a child who had been lost, and a guy who found the child and was worried about doing even anything with him because he might be accused of pedophilia. And that's such a fear and predominant image in our world today, and it just seems to limit the possibilities so much. I think we've got a lot of fear right now. Here's another one about children. This one was about my other son who was going to kindergarten for the first day, and so this is called First Day. September barely begun, my son and I waited at the end of our lane, at the edge of a wood's long shadows, watching the spot in our neighbor's cornfield where the road crested, hillside warming with sun, where we knew the school bus would first rise today and keep rising every weekday. I wondered at how things are quietly revealed by emerging through shadows of closeness and separation. Maybe I imagined yellow in the tilting crowns of birch, a winter already gathering under their green. I thought of the bus arriving as if from a great distance, bearing bright symbols down from the sun, the glint in George Washington's eye, the vibration of long division, powers of 2, 4, 8, a river of letters rolling toward us, MISSISSIPPI, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria climbing over the horizon to discover us, blinking at wood's edge. Would it finally outshine the strange wonder of sun that now enthralled him, replacing sky with the name of the district he'll always belong to, filling the field with a doorway? How small will he grow as he climbs up the steep steps and disappears in the churning aisle? I wished we could stay in the shelter of birches, watching for a world that never arrived, keeping the quiet comprehension of deer or voles, of every speechless hidden life, until we learned how to cross over and back, with school district funding problems in Wisconsin, those bus rides are going to get longer and longer, it seems like. This poem, I wanted to switch gears to, we had some children poems, and those poems, the last one is in my collection that's for sale out here, Without Us, which focuses on imagery of northern Wisconsin and nature. This one goes the other direction to old men, and it actually got started almost as a kind of a, I was trying to goad a friend of mine by email into an argument, and I think I said something to him like, oh, isn't there something great about really old, disgusting men, you know, just really something you can appreciate and get into, kind of those Charles Bukowski guys? And he's like, what the hell are you talking about? No. And so I thought, well, I gotta figure this out, because I was fascinated by sort of the breakdown of things. And I think I'd read some article in the New Yorker that used the phrase la grande cuisine, so I had to use it. The sour taste of old men. I think of them as a roux from la grande cuisine, conflicting tones married temporarily, a sweetness undermined by bitter, that dark monologue, death rehearsing alone in a corner while the beautiful harmonize, a bright lemony trumpet blaring in the sad cathedral of butter, cayenne, cumin, and cloves yelping orgasms, their coital arias shattering the funeral of salt and flour, a fragile unity held only by the potency of their failures. And those inner marriages outlived, like the green gone from trees. What do you think makes the fire of their golds and garish reds but the elements wandering away from each other, the parts going separately into the woods where they were made to sit down and contemplate their undoing, a curdling in the breath while they still can sing? I've heard the sticky hormones shift with age, that the heat in testicles gives way to another river that was always moving beneath our urgencies. I shall grow breast then, become round and sour in my conceiving, the loosened selves pouring out of me like milk. This is another poem from the Japan Chat book, which also has to do with men kind of in their predicaments. The problem of this poem was that you're not supposed to do this in creative writing workshops. You know, it doesn't matter if it really happened. But this poem really happened, you know, and that made it a kind of a challenge to write it, because it was a better story in life than it probably is as a poem. But it's just this descriptive moment that I had to kind of capture. And although it has nothing to do with Elizabeth Bishop's poem, The Man Moth, I read it over and over while I was writing it nonetheless, but there's no connection really. Deep in the western suburbs, so this happened in Tokyo, waiting for a train, autumnal moths rose from tall grass along tracks, around restless commuters on platforms, into burning sodium lamps, and farther into tungsten stars, flying away like used up loves. Some stuck in a rich man's wool coat, burying heads in Italian nap while he read the news. 10, then hundreds thirsting for new sweetness, fastening mouths, pumping splintered powdery wings, raising satisfied abdomens. His train arrived. I was there. And he stepped on without glancing up from his reading, his suit trembling alive, doors enclosing us all like a sentence. Sliding out of the station, we all watched him, absorbed in his words, no one daring to speak, a sentient language cloaking him in need. The scattering would come, oh yes, but for just then, pause. We were all a brief assemblage of scents upon the skin, a collection of raw thirst. So he was kind of a man moth. He was covered with moths. This is the title poem from the new book, the new chat book that's coming out, called The Body We Gather. And this is really based on a ritual at Japanese funerals. If you use Japanese chopsticks when you're eating, you're not ever supposed to stick them down into the rice or hand pieces of food from one person to another using the chopsticks. And the reason you're not supposed to do that particular thing is because of this funeral ritual, which is the only time when people are allowed to pass one thing from one set of chopsticks to another. And what they're doing is called passing bones. This is something that actually happens at Japanese funerals. The bones of the deceased are laid out, and the friends and family members will pick them up with chopsticks and pass them to each other. The Body We Gather. One. After our friend Mickey died, they placed her cremated bones on a white cloth, their gloved hands working in careful silence, setting the pieces down as if she would feel the woven textures of the linen, like settling a frightened child into bed or returning a stunned moth to a leaf, until they'd finished. And facing the assembled mourners, the priest said, "This is Mickey." Two. I say Mickey, and what I mean is this word carried from a kiln, laid on smooth linen, an invitation we are given to lift it with chopsticks after it's fallen to pieces, like pieces of a broken pot or abandoned shells, a once living substance barely held together, thin petals that could collapse into dust we lift, pass to each other, set in the urn. Three. I say urn, and I mean the body we gather from these fragments, the way after the ritual we feel Mickey dispersed and intermingled in the mountains, the forests of bamboo, in wind coming off the bay at night, paper doors rattling in their frames, the bodies of sleepers inside held inches away without making a sound. My wife and I, still alive, slipping down into the bay's black water. 4. What we might have said then doesn't matter. I mean the words in their dispersions, their failure to hold on to meaning, are like lights on the water, reflections we can't lift. I mean the words are dissolving pieces of each other we touch that are always falling apart as we try to lift them. 5. To gather in this urn full of ash. This is the last one I'll read. I don't think I've ever read it before. It's for my father. I wanted to read it because even though it's about a surgery, it's kind of uplifting, I think. At least it is to me. He likes golf a lot, and I have spent some time trying to get into golf. I played it when I was a kid, but the more I play it, the more I kind of like it. It's filled with strange contradictions, it seems like, about nature, and yet it's very civilized. But I decided that what I wanted him to think about when he was having this surgery was a round of golf. So it's called Triple Bypass as a Round of Golf. For my father. At this moment, when you are about to sleep, a mask descending over your eyes, breath slowed to a winter thickness, and all of them gathered around the small flower of light on your chest. At this moment, when you are about to fall into the chill of anesthesia, I hope a fairway appears with a breeze riffling on the rough, cornfields ablaze in the sharp light of 1966, and behind you in the clubhouse, the young wives in cotton dresses holding vodka tonics, laughing, making salad, dancing as they move. I hope you see past the cool invitations of pines to the green, the putting surface stretched out like a swelling voice, like a thin wire tensed in the heat, plucked by dragonflies with their upcurling abdomens, wings opening on grass. I hope you feel sparrows at rest in your skin, a lifting or hovering of scents in the air just above you, your breath held in a twilight in which the young couples you knew walk down from their comforts into the evening you now inhabit. A procession going into you as if down fairways of dissolving sensation. They become the summer you moved in. Greens deserted after the last ones made their putts and went home. Then dark spreads from the fields that were always out of bounds, where deer come out like unmet friends to graze, new shoots shining in your approaches. Thank you.